welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is the 6th, can you believe it? Hardly the 6th of September 2020 when we're airing this live, because we'll probably air it again. So if you feel like you're time traveling, you are.
Yeah.
Except for today. Today you're not time traveling.
That's correct.
Well, I mean, how do I know that, though? Really?
Yeah. How do you know you weren't already here?
All right, Bill.
All right.
Do we have a sponsor today?
Yeah, we do. Our sponsor is Papin Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And if you need John Deere Ag equipment, you need John Deere Turf equipment, you need Honda, you need steel, they've got it all down there. Go by and see them. And, or give them a call, 226-9226, and they can get you fixed up. Or you can get them on the web at
what?
www.papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
Well, isn't that fun?
Yeah. So there you go. Don't stare at me like that. Don't give me that eye.
I never get tired of doing that.
Yeah.
I don't. I just never get tired of it. It's like, say something, Bill, and it's like,
stop looking at me.
See him like locking up like children in the backseat of a car. It's not good.
He's touching me.
That's actually really not good. I knew you were going there, though. So we're continuing a conversation today, which should frighten you. But it's something that really needs to be chatted about, because I actually was it was last night. They had somebody on TV, I think it was Rand Paul, and they said, well, who's funding all of this, you know, all these protests and all this anarchy? And he's like, well, I don't know, but we should get to the bottom of it. And I thought, gee whiz, he should call our guest, William Kay, or listen to our show, or do both. Because we did a show on this last week, so we just, I guess I just wasn't feeling very clever. I just called this Black Lives Matter, the Ford Foundation, and the Black Movement Oligarchy Part 2 with our guest, William Kay. He lives in Alberta, Canada, and started with a radio program, go figure that out, and was doing all sorts of things on environmentalism. And his website is ecofascism.com. So before you're thinking, well, I don't know if I care about environmentalism, no, you do, because there's a whole bunch of other stuff besides that on there. And it's very interesting how the tactics and the personnel and all that of the hard environmental left, for anybody who's lived anywhere where they've, you know, had spotted owls or longhorn beetles or any other stupid thing we've got to save that.
Red-legged frogs.
Oh, yeah, red-legged frogs.
Fairy shrimp.
You've encountered these people, and now we're watching them take this to a whole new level. I guess they went after the Kentucky Derby today. I'm assuming that didn't go well.
That was yesterday.
That was yesterday?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's Sunday. They don't do Kentucky Derby on Sunday, do they? Yeah. Well, maybe they do. You know, it's the virus. Everything that's screwed up.
They had it yesterday without a crowd. There was nobody in the stands, which seems kind of odd to me.
Because you can't be outside and watch a horse race?
Yeah,
or
no,
a horse
no
thing?
You can't. No,
it's not
can't.
Really a race.
You might sit next to somebody accidentally and breathe on them. Yeah, terrible.
Touching.
Yeah, I don't think they wanted to mess around with the folks in Kentucky. I think that might have been a bad move.
Huh. Well, I guess we all need to be more like the folks in Kentucky, huh? So, Mr. K, I know we sort of asked a lot of questions and derailed you from your super good plan last week.
I no longer live in Alberta.
Oh, you don't?
I have moved. Yeah. Yes, I moved back to my homeland, Saskatchewan.
Oh, that's hard.
To an undisclosed location.
No, Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay.
We're dying in Saskatchewan. Come get me. It's good to be back. I've been away for a long, long time. This is where I'm from originally.
Is it a... okay, so obviously I don't speak Canadian. So is Saskatchewan a town or a place, like a region?
It is a province.
Okay.
Much as you have states,
yeah.
This is a province. The provinces go from west to east, British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan.
Okay.
So we're third in. We're directly north of Montana. Probably about where I'm right now, about 500 miles northwest of Fargo, North Dakota, just to give you a location you might be familiar with.
Wow.
But we're north of there. Yeah. The Saskatchewan border also touches a bit on the North Dakota border.
Huh.
So just if you can think North Dakota, Montana, and just think directly north. In fact, the city I'm in right now, Regina, is quite close to the U.S. border.
Oh, okay. well, that's kind of fun. Okay, okay. Yeah. I'll get rid of Alberta in there.
Yeah, it's good to get out of Alberta. It's in dire straits.
Oh, is it really?
Double whammy, the COVID. But it was, Saskatchewan's a far more diversified economy than Alberta is. Alberta, although they talked about diversification for the last 50 years, they certainly never practiced it. They are almost entirely dependent on the oil patch and the collapse of the oil price, and then the COVID, it's really knocked it out of them. The provincial government is now borrowing 60% of its budget, 60.
Wow.
Oh, well, I'm sure that'll work out.
So how much of that is timber?
Timber in Alberta?
Yeah.
Less than 5%.
Oh, wow.
And is...
It's really oil and gas. So, see, all the western provinces have dubbed some timber industry. Like, there's unlimited forests here. But
we don't want to use it.
Harvest them.
Yeah, it's just like here. But yeah, it's
interesting. We'd rather watch them burn, you know.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. You can't even see the other side of our town today. It's it looks like somebody threw a blanket over the whole place. Kind of a brown, ugly, furry blanket.
It's a travesty.
Yeah.
You know, the amount that we lose in fires that they could be burning, and they say, well, how are we going to stop these fires? Well, why don't we just clear the forest, you know, and move in, farmers and what have you. I mean, it's not as though there's any sort of shortage of timber out there. Certainly not in this country. The timber harvest in Canada is 1 over 400. It's 1/400 of the actual forest mass. And forest is considered old growth in Canada if it's over 100 years. So we could quadruple the harvest, and we still would not make a dent in it.
It's interesting in here. I don't know. I think the concept of old growth, it just means if it's a tree. You know, they used to talk about it with meaning, but now it's just if it's a tree. Well, it's old growth. I had someone tell me that. I'm like, really?
To the environmentalist, it was a pretty tree.
Ooh.
You know, it was cathedral stands, which are quite often second and third growth. But if they look nice, then if they could put them on a calendar or something, that they called that old growth.
Yeah,
a lot of the real old growth wasn't too pleasing to the eye, so they didn't pay much attention to that.
Well, that's kind of funny. So it looks like we have the same, we have the exact same problem where we are in the West. And our difficulty with that is the people in the East don't have that type of timber to harvest. So.
Oh, they do. They do.
Our guys don't
really. New York State is 75% forest.
Right. But when you look at where our lawmakers are, you know, Florida, a lot of these places, I mean, the West is where our huge timberlands are, and they're super rural, so the number of people representing them is really very small. I talk to people all the time on the East Coast, and they'll say, well, you know, that you've cut down all the redwoods. It's like, oh.
Mm.
It's too bad it's 3,000 miles away, or I'd be like, you know, you need to come over and take a look at that.
They grow like weeds.
That's a lie.
You need to come over and get lost in some of these forests.
Yeah, right. That's true, too. Where do you want to start today? You have a three-pager that you wrote last week that we, I think, successfully kept you from talking about. We have 1 minute until our break. Oops. And so how about this? When we come back from our – well, set it up. So when we come back from our break, what are we talking about for the next for the rest of the show, the remainder of the show?
Let's start talking a bit about some of the efforts by the Ford Foundation to recruit all of the philanthropies into their efforts. And I'll start with that, and we get a lead from that again.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, this whole thing really does need to be exposed in a really organized way, so we'll do our level best not to derail you, but...
derail me all you want.
Well, people are being...
My whole life
just
in a slow motion train wreck. Come on.
We can derail you without even trying.
People are just being lied to so much about where this is all happening, and they're... I mean, I talk to people every day who believe all this.
In Trump's interview, you mentioned Rand Paul said something about he didn't know who was funding it. In Trump's interview, he goes, it's being funded by some very stupid rich people. But he didn't seem to have any names or organizations to attach to that either.
Which was probably good, because that would give them immunity, because then they'd say that they were just calling hate on him, which is just irritating.
Calling down the hate.
All right. Quick break. We'll come back. We're going to celebrate a little free enterprise, and we'll be back with our guest, William Kay. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at We the People Radio. www.papetmachinery.us.
But good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
There we go. I had a special song for you, William. We will cue that up and surprise you with it. How's that?
Okay.
That wasn't it, though. It was a special one for Canada. This is how you can just let that bubble
oh,
around.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you
oh,
should
no.
be afraid.
Oh, no. Oh, that's fun. Hey, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a crucial component of what is happening because it explains the motivation of the main funder. And keep in mind, these are not radical people. These are people who simply want affirmative action on steroids. They've already benefited from these programs to a great degree, but they want to keep that gravy train flowing. And part of that is to get more money out of philanthropies in general, to the black movement, and I define the black movement very broadly, you know, organizations that have black in their name, that put the advancement of African-Americans in their agenda. And these affect, you know, health equity. These are groups that want more black nurses. They want better treatment of blacks and black medical treatment for blacks and black neighborhoods. It deals with criminal justice reform. There's 101 issues that they can agitate around, but they typically are fighting for a better deal for black people within those sectors. Now, there's a number of groups, at least three that I know that the Ford Foundation is funding. One is called Race and Equity in Philanthropy, and it's a 800-member networking enterprise that just tries to sort of mingle and network and hold various functions whereby this group can sit down and talk with philanthropists about, you know, upping their budget for black people. There's a group called Racial Equity and Philanthropy Fund, which consists of 17 different nonprofits that more or less keep scorecards on all the different philanthropies, and then they can hound these philanthropies about how much money you're giving to the black cause. But probably the most important of the three is a group called the Association of Black Foundation Executives. And this is a 50-year-old organization. It has 16 directors, all of whom are black. You have to be black to be a director of this organization. And it consists of black people who have got good jobs within other foundations. And they're quite a bit different from the Ford Foundation, which is actually a black-dominated foundation. These people, the 16 members here, none of whom represent the Ford Foundation, are typically, you don't want to use the word token, but they're the only black guy, the only black face that you'll see in these philanthropies. Like the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation has a vice president called Corey Anderson, he's black, and the MacArthur Foundation has a vice president called Kenneth Jones, and he's black. You get the picture. But a lot of the big foundations do have one black guy there who does sort of manage the black portfolio for that foundation. When you have all these riots and all these turmoils, it makes it a lot easier for those people to talk to their bosses and their boards and say, you know, you've got to put more money into the black envelope so that we can quell and sort of meet these people's needs, et cetera. So part of the explanation of this is these philanthropies and the individuals inside them are using this as a means to get a bigger budget next year around. And this applies, you know, all down the line, the arts, in the universities as well. There's all these black studies programs. They didn't exist 40 years ago, and now there's over 100 of them out there at various universities. And they teach, you know, black studies, black history, you name it. And, of course, they almost exclusively hire black people or people pretending to be black people to do it. So it's a way for this.
Like that girl from Washington?
Yeah, there was another one, but this one came out on her own. She probably was about to be exposed. But, yeah, there's a lot of that. It's huge in Canada. It's a huge industry, people pretending to be native. Because you get all kinds of benefits, certainly in the university system, if you can somehow claim to be native. And time and again, you know, they'll give some big award to some native writer, and then a couple of years later, he's exposed as not having a drop of native blood in him. We see that in Canada. And you're seeing that in the States as well. Because a lot of the pressure, you know, the competition to get a professorial job at a university is intense. And there's so many people with PhDs right now. So, if whatever works, you know, a lot of people, you know, Elizabeth Warren, another example. There's a whole bunch of them who fake racial heritages in order to get these positions. And it's what you buy when you actually have preferential treatments for racial groups. You get all this crap along with it. But to see what's really motivating the philanthropists and the ones who are putting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into black activism, the name of the game is to cause a big fuss and then it's a protection racket, and then go after the big money, trying to get more money out of them. You know, and it's, I was looking at this one guy, his name is James Head. He's the CEO of the Oakland Bay East Community Foundation. $250 million in assets. And you can tell that, you know, he doesn't have a lot of power. He doesn't put in a lot of money into the black movement, but I was sort of going over their annual reports. And there's about 20 or 30 grants that he's handing out every year, you know, to the Prison Radio Project or to Brothers on the Rise or Black Organizing Project, and they're not worth a lot. Like, they're $25,000, $50,000 grants. But then you stand back and think about it. This guy's walking around Oakland, and he's handing out, you know, dozens of grants, you know, to people in Oakland in these poor neighborhoods. He's got a lot of clout. He's got a lot of street cred. Because a lot of these small groups, you know, they really need that, you know, $20,000 or $30,000. Plus, it gives them a lot of imprimatur. When they go to get grants from other people, they can say, well, we got a grant from, you know, the Oakland East Bay Community Foundation. So, you know, a guy like that, even though it doesn't look like he's handing out a lot of money, he's probably only handing out $500,000 a year in Oakland personally. Because he manages this whole fund, but the fund itself is not putting a lot of money into the black movement. So it looks, on one hand, it looks like, well, he isn't really contributing much. And then if you stop and think about it, you know, what does it mean to, you know, to move around a poor neighborhood and be able to hand out checks like that to all those people? He has a lot of clout. He's someone who can say, you know, I want a demonstration on this square at this time, and he can get it done.
Right.
And what I've known from the movement is you don't have to spend a lot of money to get people out.
Yeah,
to get them to show up. Now, is what you're finding, are they paying people directly, or are they just financing the, you know, the
organization.
Pallets of bricks?
They finance the nonprofits.
Yeah.
You know, they don't, like, you know, you're not going to see receipts for bricks and bottles and things like appearing on the annual reports of the East Bay Community Foundation.
I don't know.
It's kind of funny to see that. So they finance a lot of catered meetings. That's crucial in a poor neighborhood. You know, you got to make sure they're well fed, taken care of, and you can get the bodies in the room, and you can sort of recruit from there, and you can sort of pick out the people who are going to be willing to be involved in activism. But you're never going to get this direct, you know, we are paying so much per broken window, so much for damaged car. That's never going to come out. And what I've noticed over the last week, and others have noticed as well, the Black Lives protests are toned down quite a bit. Except for what happened in Kenosha, seems to be a bit of a pulling back, and that seems to be the big money, the Democratic Party, starting to push down on the brake a bit. This is getting a bit out of control, which nothing that Trump said was accurate. He describes stupid rich people are paying for this, but he also says, he said it twice, this is getting away from them. They started something that now they can't quite control, and that's something I noticed as well, and that's going along with now, it looks like there's an effort now to sort of pull back on this a bit. it's a long ways to go before the election. And if it keeps escalating, mayhem by then. And it, exactly. I think it's starting to negatively impact the Democrats.
Well, because people are starting to ask a lot of, even the, you know, some of the broadcasters that don't want to ask, it's become so apparent that if you don't ask, you really do look like you're part of the problem.
Unless you're talking about Portland. Portland seems to be.
Oh, in which case, yeah, all bets are off.
Its own thing.
Yeah, and it's also, if you notice the protesters, they're 99% white.
Yep.
The LA Times had a piece on that today, but a lot of these Black Lives Matter protests, you know, they're overwhelmingly white, and it's starting to look kind of embarrassing. I mean, does it really make any sense that these people would be so angry about what's going on? And it doesn't really make any sense. I certainly have encountered over the years some people that are sort of almost deranged in their anti-racism. You wonder what they're compensating for. These are white people, and their animosity, it seems to be out of step or out of magnitude. With the fact, I mean, I can't imagine getting that worked up and that emotional about it, about events that are happening in other cities. But I've encountered that, and it's something that's coming out of the universities a lot as well. I'm looking at Portland, and I had to go back and check some websites. If you want to get into the mindset of these people, there's one website called It's Going Down. I don't know if she can be putting this on the air. There's another one called Submedia, and there's one called Crime Think, although Think is spelled with a C. If you visit those websites, you can sort of get a glimpse into the mind of the people who are doing this. And I know this community well, and I can say that it is thoroughly bogus. And if there's any anarchists out there, you know, these people in Singapore, I'm sure there's some anarchists in Singapore listening. The key concept is the structure. The tyranny of structurallessness. The word is structurelessness. The tyranny of that. Because when you get involved in these organizations, they brag about how decentralized they are and how they really don't have any organizational structure, etc. Then over time, you realize, oh, they do have a structure. It's just it's not up for grabs. There's sort of a hidden structure inside the organization, and it has set the entire agenda, and it is moving forward, and it masquerades as though there's actually no central control, no central management. That's not at all true.
Well, do you think I think it starts out without a structure, and then as it progresses, I think they realize, you know, we got to get organized, and the next thing you know, they do have a structure.
Well, you get your little playbooks from the Antifa folks and that. But let's face it, the media is completely feeding the narrative, which allows them to continue. We'll be right back with our guest. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Came here to drink. We're all mud flaps and bourbons, all ball caps and turbans, all prom queens and strippers. We're the whole kitchen sink, and in here we're the same. Everyone knows your name. We just raise up our glass. We don't give a rat's ass if you're a Democrat or Republican.
There. I just wanted you to know we're not so different, William.
Yeah, that was a very positive message. Back to these...
We're just trying to be Canadians.
Back to these anarchists.
We'll never be as good as Canadians. We're drinking.
Particularly in the North Pacific Northwest, there's a very old tradition of anarchism. It's where the Wobblies were, the IWW... They've got structured or sort of quasi-structured anarchist organizations going back well over a century there. And Trump actually mentioned that. He was like, you know, Portland's been burning for 100 years. He's obviously getting someone sitting down and explaining to him there's a deeply, deeply ingrained anarchist culture in the Pacific Northwest. Places like Eugene, Oregon, I can't tell you how many times I've met anarchists from that one little city. So it is there. It's structured in that community. It's second, third generation there now. But in terms of the mob, you know, the big black block mobs that they form, what you don't see in there are, A, there's a lot of very well-paid university professors that are involved in this, and they each have their own sort of, you know, coterie of followers that tag along with them, and a lot of them, of course, are trying to get academic jobs as well. You also don't see what I noticed with my involvement in the radical left and the anarchist community is you find a lot of very, very rich people. I met two daughters of billionaires dressed in rags, you know, slumming it with these people, but they were very much part of the scene. And I met several other people as well, and these people have no intentions of spending their lives down with this community. But you do notice them there, and they are very influential in that community. And the third group that you don't notice are the police agents, which are shot through that organization. The American government for a long time has viewed the white supremacist, white nationalist, whatever you call them, as a main threat to social stability. And one of the mechanisms they use to contain that group beyond sort of infiltration, split and wreck operations are groups like Antifa and the Southern Law Poverty Center. And these groups have a remarkable amount of information on the white supremacist community, and they're always doxing them, and they're always harassing them. And wherever those groups try to hold a meeting, these groups mobilize to throw rocks at them and what have you. I can remember back in the day, Antifa, there was forerunners to Antifa. We're always trying to organize, you know, let's go and attack these Nazis. And other people are pointing out, look, there's only six of them, okay? I mean, we didn't, you know, certainly in Canada, there's absolutely no political threat. They're never going to run for office. Why even worry about them? But there was always this element in there that were just absolutely determined to make that the central issue, that every time white identitarians or white nationalists have any kind of assembly, we were all supposed to show up with bats and attack them. You know, and it seemed to a lot of us as a complete waste of time because they're basically a dead end. I mean, odious as they are, they're not going anywhere. There's a potential they might start, you know, splintering off and then shooting people, but there's not really much you can do about that. I think what the explanation of that is that there are a lot of government agents within that, you know, black, you know, people all dressed in black and their helmets and what have you. And it's nothing. It's a typical feature of fascism is that you'll have police involved in like that, and there's tacit approval of the authorities for what they're doing, even though they're clearly breaking the law. Like, how many times have we seen videos of Antifa assaulting someone in broad daylight, and the police are watching it? And that is going on because these things sort of connect at the top. And what the authorities really fear is an uprising of sort of the, you know, backwoods, redneck, racist people. And they put a lot of effort into stopping that. And to some degree, this anarchist community has been co-opted in that. And they're sort of the boot boys for the authorities. Of course, they would never admit that. But that is also one of the factors that's going on. And it just shows how fake they are. You know, for all of their talk about anarchism and what have you, these are groups that are basically run by university professors and cops and by very wealthy people. So there's a real phoniness to them. I mean, I really don't take sides. They say if you see the Antifa fighting the Pride Boys, you're supposed to pray for a meteorite. You're not supposed to take sides. I'm sort of inclined in that direction, but actually I have no you know affinity whatsoever with the other side of that equation either, but it's important to keep that in mind when you see this anarchist movement. There's a lot more going on beneath the surface than appears. But there's also, you know, there's a lot of basically bedrock good people within the anarchist community. I've met a lot of them. These are people who, they ride the rails all over North America. They live in abandoned warehouses. They make their own sort of soup kitchens and what have you, and they're completely off the grid. And they tend to be sort of good people, you know. I attended a Utah Phillips concert one time in a church basement. There must have been 300 people there. When he sang Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, half the crowd knew the lyrics. Oh, that's wow. The Pacific Northwest, okay? Yeah. And it's deeply ingrained in their culture. And I don't really have a problem with them. You know, they make their own bikes, usually run co-op bike stores, and they have these sort of soup kitchens that they create. They're all volunteer run. These people are basically okay. And they're, they're definitely anti-racist for sure, but they're not all that sort of whipped up about this. So, you know, I think America is sort of a big tent place, and there's a place for people like that in there. They're to some extent they're being manipulated and led around by the nose by the sort of other elements mm-hmm. within that community. But I'm not someone who really I know that constituency well, the sort of Pacific Northwest anarchist scene. I know it quite well, and for the most part, they are not harmful people. There are a lot of squatters and things like that, but they live completely below the radar, and you got to sort of respect that. I mean, it's sort of they can get away with it, and they live like that for so long, but I don't really have a problem with them. I see how that they're being mobilized in this action. What's going on in Portland is really never, I've never seen anything like that before, like 100 nights in a row. But once again, we're dealing with a crowd that's probably 95% white, and they're all whipped up into a frenzy about the murder of a black guy halfway across the continent.
Yeah.
Well, the other piece of this that really has to be said, I think people realize it, but never assume. A lot of times the police, if you're talking about city police departments, they're run by the city council. They're not an independent force. They're a department of the city government, no different than the water department or the solid waste department or any of that. They're a department. And so when your boss tells you you're not allowed to do whatever, X, Y, and Z, and that's not in your job description, they don't get to independently go out and... even though it's against the law, and I don't know how you do that as a policeman, but your boss tells you you're not allowed to do anything about it, and so there they are, you know? And there's a lot of that going on in our bigger cities until it gets bad enough, and then somebody says, gee, you know, maybe we should start enforcing the law. I'm not sure how bad that has to get, but I think Ted Wheeler's going to find out, though.
We're just reading a Q&A with Ted.
Yeah, he's watching the machine come after
here. Well, that's the humorous part of that, is they keep attacking him.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, they've got some other candidate, some other mayoral candidate waiting in the wings who declares herself to be 100% Antifa. I think maybe the objective is to drive Ted right out of town so they can have their candidate take over. And I do not know what that's going to look like. If it gets any crazier than this. I should never use the word crazy. But it's pretty wild there right now. And I have seen this article that there was the Antifa candidate for mayor. They've got someone in the wings that is going to be even more of a Ted than Ted. And part of the antiquated structure of Portland is that the mayor is also the top police commissioner. And this is what Ted is now using for his excuse for not speaking out against the rioting, is it would violate his duty as police commissioner because he's supposed to keep all this in-house.
Mm. Oh, I didn't know that.
I did not know that either.
But it sounds like BS to me. Portland does have sort of an antiquated structure. The police commissioner and the mayor are the same person, which is not normal.
Well, yeah. therein lies the problem.
Yeah, you know, there's got to be something else going on there because you know, when he comes out for him in the beginning, and now they're attacking him. He's going
to
be gone.
Well, when he went to that
and they
protest,
will put somebody in there that they like.
Yeah. He goes to the protest, and he's like, you guys are, you know, he's like cheering them on, and then they all turn on him like a bunch of rabid dogs. I have to say, that was a good night of news. I did enjoy that.
Fireworks in the lobby of his as a condo building.
Yeah,
he had to move.
Yeah, how'd you like to be his neighbor? Well, and in most of the other cities, how does it work up where you are? Would they be able to get away with this night after night after night, or are they, and we're just not hearing about it?
The only time I recall this happening was in Quebec. There were some plans to severely cut the education budget, and they had this night after night grinding, you know, but as in Portland, kind of a mild riot. I mean, if you read the history of the world's riots, these ones are pretty mild. I mean, they've had a couple of fatalities. There's been riots where hundreds have died. We had the same sort of thing in Quebec and Montreal, Quebec City and Montreal. It was over educational cutbacks. And eventually the government capitulated, but you had the same sort of thing of just people amassing every night, you know, assailing government buildings every night, and eventually the government capitulated. So there are other examples of that. See the Yellow Vest movement in France, was sort of starting to do that. Like every Saturday, they were showing up. They were showing up in massive numbers.
Right.
And these were, although Yellow Vesters meant other things in other parts of the world, in France, these were mainstream people. It started out as a protest against motor fuel, gasoline prices. And it just escalated just riot after riot.
So
you see, you know, it can happen. There was a city of Regina, where I live, we're holding weekly ban the mask protests. Like, I march against the mask. We don't want to have to wear these masks anymore. And I talk to the organizers, and as of next week, it's going to be a mask burning. Every Saturday, we're going to show up, and we're going to burn these little masks.
Oh,
wow, I hope that takes
the COVID clampdown.
It'll be small fires.
Yeah. Yeah, look what's happening in Germany right now. There are countries where they really are protesting against this COVID thing. It's not even about the COVID virus. It's the response to the virus that's the problem.
Right.
But it does help to have sort of a, but in Portland, what's unusual is it's every night. Like, it's easier for activists to organize something if it's a weekly. But you're asking a lot of people to come out every night. And that's one of their chants. We're here, we're tight, we do this every night. They chant that, and then they go out and create mayhem.
Yeah, and
we're not dealing with thousands, we're dealing with hundreds of people in Portland that are doing almost all of it.
Well, I just wonder how long the business community is going to stand for that. You know, could you imagine? You live downtown, or you run a business downtown, and it blows up every single night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they usually start kind of late. I don't know. And they have different spots. Like, for the longest time, they were fixated on that courthouse. So it would just really be the businesses around there that would be impacted. I've seen other articles online saying, they're making a point of it, showing, Portland at 2 o'clock at some suburb. And, there's lots of places in Portland you wouldn't even know this is going on. It is fairly concentrated in one area of the city. A lot of Portlanders, if you want to avoid it, you can. You don't have to go down there. You don't have to shop in that area. You could just sort of tune it all out, turn off the radio, and go about your business, and you probably wouldn't even notice it.
No.
So it's a mistake to say that Portland's burning, the whole city's on fire.
Yeah, sure.
It's a concentrated area where it's happening.
Yeah, the bad part is if you get stuck in that part, you're screwed.
Well, and they're moving it around a little bit, too. They're starting to spill out.
They do. They do. They switch it up.
Yeah. The point is they can't stop them. That's the thing. They show up, they do their thing, and then they go away. And it doesn't seem like the police are willing.
They're certainly not getting instructions. Of course, there's always that we mentioned last week. There's a danger of over escalating things. You don't want that crowd to arm any more than they are. And I was surfing a lot of these anarchist websites. And man, they are all arming. And they're all posting stuff about how you've got to start getting weapons, etc. So that is something that is happening in the subsurface, which hasn't happened before.
Right.
So I think to some degree the authorities in the Pacific Northwest are mindful of that. And if they can sort of, de-escalate things, keep in mind, and Americans might not be aware of this, but policing is supposed to be predicated on the doctrine of minimal force. And we can get into this because one of the topics I wanted to talk about is there is a grievance there. I'm noticing all these other groups are popping up, but there's a real problem in America about police violence. And if you want to look at something like, go to the wiki and just look up something like killings by law enforcement officers by country. And the United States is way, way above what any other sort of Western industrialized country is. There are worse countries. I mean, you could be in Venezuela, you can be in Jamaica. There's places where the police killings are just mind-boggling how many people they're killing. But at the same time, the United States is in there with Angola and Iran and places like that. It's killing, I think it's 34.8 people per 10 million a year, per million a year. I can't remember what it is here, per 10 million. Whereas, the UK, it's less than one. I mean, American police are killing 60 times more people per capita than it's happening in Britain. And there's a lot of countries like that. They're killing
I don't think they're allowed to carry guns there, are they? I mean, to kill them, they'd have to pay. paper companies do that, I think, over there.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't they?
If they need them. The regular bobbies don't.
Oh, okay.
But the definitely the police are armed there, as are the criminals. But it's not just the U.K. I could list probably 30 countries in Europe and in the...
Hold that thought, and we'll play the Ted Wheeler theme song, and then we'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You are listening to We the People Radio.
I don't want you to tell me it's time to come home. I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life.
Oh. All right, that's enough of that.
Kim Carnes, enough of you. So statistically, I didn't really know anybody in Canada carried weapons either.
If you can find the investigation to modern Western industrialized countries, the bar graph would be sort of everybody's at, one or two, and then boom, the U.S., 35, pretendably. So... the U.S. has 150 times more police killings than Japan, 20 times more than Australia, way more than New Zealand. These are sort of countries that in many ways are similar to the U.S., but the U.S. stands out in very stark contrast with lethal police killings. I like what, Rand Paul introduced some legislation about no more no-knock warrants. Like, no more just bust the door down and start shooting. That would be absolutely unacceptable in a lot of these other places. One of the things that Edmonton had, I used to live there, that I thought was a good idea. They have a regular police force, fully armed. They've got a SWAT team, fully armed. And then they have this additional constabulary that's unarmed. And they do a lot of the beat patrols, and they do a lot of the bicycle patrols, and they do a lot of the garden variety, drunken disorderly, shoplifting, domestic disputes. They attend to a lot of those. And they don't have guns. And I think Americans would be surprised at how much police work can be done with you don't really have to have a gun. They just show up. You're just taking a report. You're there at a motor vehicle accident, what have you. And they can do a lot of the work. If they ever get threatened by someone with a gun, they can just stand back, get out of there, and then hit a little button on their radio, and then whoever that was is in a world of trouble now. But there are ways that you could probably get that number down. The smart Republicans... would admit there's a problem here. I mean, the police killings in the U.S. are just astronomically higher than any other modern industrialized world. And what can be done to bring that number down? So a lot of these people screaming in the street, it's not as though they don't have a grievance. They're being exploited. There's all sorts of political factions and philanthropies and what have you that want to exploit this grievance for their own interests. But it's not as though there isn't a problem. There is. I also came across an interesting commentary about, someone trying to explain why this is happening so much in the States. And his theory was that a lot of the police departments hire combat veterans from the Army. And at first blush, it seems like that'd be a good idea. Those guys would make good cops. But in second thought, maybe they wouldn't make good cops because when their conditioned reflexes kick in, they're going to be very likely to draw their weapons and fire. So that was another thought of someone kicking around ideas of how really could they deal with that? Because, it's not as though you don't have a problem. You do. It's being exploited, for sure. But I think the smart Republicans, like Rand Paul, are thinking about ways to really get that number down, to minimize the degree to which the police are using that kind of lethal force. Because it's completely abnormal, I assure you, modern industrial Western world.
I don't know how it is in other states, but I know in California, police officers have to go through post-training. I mean, there's a lot of training you have to go through. And I know people that have applied that were military that did not make it because of exactly what you just said. So I'm not real sure that's a big part of the problem. I think a bigger part.
It might not be.
Yeah, I think a bigger part of the problem is the state of our society today. We have totally lost respect for law enforcement, and that's trickled down to the criminal element that could care less.
Well, we've green-lighted the criminal element. Drugs are okay. All this stuff's okay.
We've turned a lot of these people loose. I mean, there's a lot of problems, I think, that are attributing to the fact that people are getting shot. But I think the number one reason people are getting shot is they're resisting arrest. And if they'd stop doing that, I think
And pointing guns at the police.
I'm pretty sure I'm getting shot if I point guns at the police. I think if you resist and you're combative with the police, someone's going to get hurt. And cops are trained not to get hurt. And so, I don't know. I kind of side with law enforcement a little bit on this one. And I think a lot of it is just the restrictions we've put on cops, the society as a whole has really lost a lot of respect for cops, and this is what you end up with.
Well, a lot of what I find in majority is that people don't know anything about how law enforcement actually works. I always encourage people, if you see that there is a community use of force seminar or training or especially if there's a simulator teaching going on in your community, ask your police department to do that. Use of force training is very, very specific. I sat through one a few years ago where I had a whole bunch of people who were positive the police were just shooting everyone for no reason. And after we went through an entire day of the rules and how it works, they got into the simulator, and it was funny when the criminals pointed the guns at those people, they all shot them. It was like 100% of them shot them. And they all said, oh, my God, I had no idea that's what was going on. Like, that's how that works. It's like, how that works.
No, it's not an easy job, and they have a split.
But it would really help if people had some idea, because they think they're making it up as they go along. It's like, no, far from it. That's absolutely not happening.
No.
And they think that they get to just shoot them and run out and go do their job again. No, there's a whole big protocol for that, too. So, as with a lot of things, I think education
is
really lacking.
An explanation as to why the United States has lethal use of force by officers, 30, 50, 100 times higher than the rest of the industrialized Western world.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Germany, Poland, these places have 5% as much.
Well, do they, I don't know, here, I guess maybe they think they're going to get a break. Speaking of that, oh my gosh, we got to go. Got to do the news, then we'll be right back.
Yeah, we've walked right into it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Bad boys, what you want, what you want, what you gonna do when Chevy John Brown come for you? Tell me what you wanna do, what you gonna do.